This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Well, on this day, in 1620, a very important event happened in the history of our country. Following a perilous voyage across the Atlantic, the Mayflower Compact was signed aboard the Mayflower. The compact was the first governing document of the Plymouth Colony. It was written by Puritans fleeing religious persecution and other voyagers looking for a new start in a new land. In February, we talked about the historic document and its relationship to the U.S. Constitution with Julia Ernst, Associate Professor of Law at UND. Ernst delivered a lecture on the compact after being inspired to research it by her mother, Janet. And her mother traveled from Michigan to see her daughter's presentation because the subject touches their family. So this is an important anniversary coming up in 2020. That's the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower Compact, right?
Absolutely. And there are going to be celebrations across the country. So I would encourage everyone to watch for those celebrations. There hopefully will be a lot of lectures and information and other events. And there are particularly going to be several events in Plymouth and around Plymouth. Mom, would you like to say a few words about what's going to be happening?
Every 3 years, the General Society meets in Plymouth, Massachusetts. There's an annual meeting every year, but they go to various states throughout the United States for the other two. And there are 60-plus members normally, I believe, at the Plymouth meeting. But this coming year, the 400th anniversary, they expect so many people that Plymouth, Massachusetts is not going to be able to handle it. So they've expanded it to Provincetown and Boston also. There will be events in all three, and it's going to be very exciting.
And, of course, we should mention that Janet is with us because she's very proud of her daughter and because Janet has an ancestor named John Billington, who was among those people who were the pilgrims who landed at Plymouth Rock.
That's right. This is one of the fun stories that had been handed down to us when we were growing up as children. And Mom would tell us about this and some of our other relatives, that John Billington came over on the Mayflower. So we heard about this every Thanksgiving. But also, not only did he come over on the Mayflower, he was the first person to be hanged in the colony. And so that was something that my grandmother was quite mortified about. So she didn't like it when we raised that, but we kids thought it was absolutely fantastic.
And my husband loved to tease, so he kidded her about it all the time until she finally just had to laugh every time he brought it up.
And the law and a little history runs in the family because your late husband, J. Richard Ernst, was a retired Michigan Circuit Court judge.
Correct. We've been on all sides of the law. Well, not personally, but we have the history of the...
Well, let's a little bit more about John Billington, because we usually think of the Mayflower as having these religious dissidents going across a stormy North Atlantic and landing in a forbidding area at a tough time of the year. But religious dissidents were only part of the people who were on that first boat. There were lots of what they called strangers, right? And that was John Billington as well.
That's right.
John Billington and his wife and two boys. There were four of my ancestors actually that came over.
That's right. So. And with the so-called strangers, that was the term that the religious group who had broken off from the Church of England, they were known as the Separatists from breaking away from the Church of England, and they called themselves the Saints. And so when we think of the Pilgrims, we think of all of those who came over on the Mayflower, but they actually, the religious group who were the dissenters, called themselves the Saints, and they called these others the strangers.
the people who could do stuff, though.
That's exactly right. They were merchants, they were craftsmen,
people
they were indentured
skilled
servants. Right. They had a lot of skills that were necessary for the survival of the colony.
Now, before we start talking about the Mayflower Compact, we should mention that John Billington was rather well known as a kind of a troublemaker, wasn't he, Janet?
I guess he had his own way of thinking, and
yeah.
Right. He was more independent, but he was also very necessary for his hunting skills, building skills, and all of those things that helped them get through the first winter. All four of the Billingtons survived, and they lost half of the passengers of the Mayflower were lost the first year. It was such a hard winter.
Yeah.
They were not prepared.
And they were dying on the voyage across as well.
That's right.
There was a mutiny on the Mayflower. And so I suspect that some of that dissent and, you know, discomfort with some people probably transferred to the colony itself.
Well, it's interesting because with respect to the voyage on the Mayflower, they actually were supposed to land in what was then called Northern Virginia. They had a patent from the king or a charter from the king to establish a colony, a royal colony, in what they called Northern Virginia. It was actually the territory of Virginia went all the way up to the Hudson Bay. So they actually were supposed to be landing at the Hudson Bay, known at the time as Northern Virginia. However, they got driven off course, and when they tried to sail down the coast to land where they were supposed to be heading, the because of the fall weather and the winter storms that were coming and the rocky shoals, they decided it was too dangerous, and so they turned around and went back up to the Cape Cod region. Well, because of that, some of the so-called strangers on the ship, those who were brought over for their skills, they said, well, you actually do not have, once we land, you actually do not have the authority to govern us because we are landing in a territory that you don't have a legal claim to. And so we can go off on our own and not worry about the colonists. But the religious passengers and the leaders knew that for the survival of the colony, for the survival of all of the settlers, they would have to work together. And this is where no one was allowed to leave the ship for the permanent plantation. Of course, they had folks that had gone off exploring a bit, but they weren't allowed to disembark as a whole until they had agreed upon this compact, the Mayflower Compact, which was an agreement for their governance and that they would all agree to obey the leaders. And that's how the original Mayflower Compact came about.
So they create this Mayflower Compact, which I note John Billington signed as well.
Yes.
What was the essence of the compact, Julia?
The essence of the compact, it is very short, but the primary essence of the compact, and I'll read a short excerpt from it. It says that they hereby covenant and combine ourselves together in a civil body politic for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid, and by virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws, ordinance, acts, and constitutions, and offices from time to time as shall be thought most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. So that was the primary text of the covenant. Basically, it's a short framework, a short agreement to establish a structure of government. It isn't the laws themselves. It doesn't establish the structure of the government itself. But it is an agreement, a social contract, so to speak, that they would agree to combine together and work together and obey the governance that they established together. And that was the first such agreement that occurred in the New World. And of course, as you know, in Europe and in England, but in Europe as a whole, monarchy was still the common form of governance. And so this was a fairly radical new approach to have this governance that they all agreed to and all agreed to contribute to and obey.
Well, I also noted that it starts with the loyal subject of our dread sovereign lord, King James. Does dread mean something different in 1620?
Well, if you look at some of the religious terms as well, when we speak about, dread God the Father, that type of thing, it's more a term of respect, I think, for someone important, for a monarch, for the king, for a deity, et cetera. So not necessarily that they're dreading him, but that they're showing deference and showing loyalty to the king. Because actually, even though they were fleeing the persecution that they had faced because they were separatists, away from the Church of England, they still pledged their fealty and their loyalty to the monarch and to the king and were very, very proud to be English and proud of their English citizenship and English heritage.
And, of course, all that religion was mixed up in there. King James was son of the Queen of Scotland, who was beheaded by indirect order of Queen Elizabeth, who was the head of the Church of England. The Queen of Scotland was Catholic.
So all
this stuff is a mess.
Very much intertwined.
What went into the creation of the compact? Who wrote it? Did William Brewster write it? Or?
It actually, there's not much that has been written at all upon the about the compact itself. The original compact was lost, so we don't have the original document. The passage that I just read to you was written by William Bradford, who was one of the original governors of the colony, and it's in a book that he wrote. It was his notes, but was later published as a book, and it's called Of Plymouth Plantation, 1620 through 1647. So that is the transcription of what would have been the original document. There's another compilation of notes called Mort's Relations, a journal of the Plymouths, the Pilgrims at Plymouth. And these are some of the only original documentation that they have, but the original compact itself has been lost.
How was it enforced?
So they elected a governor then, and like I said, William Bradford was one of the original governors. Initially there was a small council. The elders of the plantation, and those who had been esteemed members within the colony, particularly those who were the religious members within the saints, the group of saints. And they were the ones who originally ran the government. Now, interestingly, as we think about our government today, we have the separation of powers, which is a very, very important component of our U.S. Constitution as it is today. So we think of the executive branch being separate from the legislative branch and being separate from the judicial branch. However, back in the original colonies, and this is, of course, not only Plymouth, but Massachusetts Bay Plantation colony and the other colonies, a lot of those functions were overlapping. So the same people who would create the laws would be the same people who would enforce the laws and would be the same people before whom trials were heard. So we didn't have that concept of the separation of powers until a bit later.
So they were very powerful people then.
Absolutely.
Did they serve until there was an effort to remove them? Or?
Well, actually, there was a fairly regular transition of power. And because, of course, each of the people who were governing were also having to do their own work and labor in the plantation. And so interestingly, the foundation of democracy within the United States started with a transition of power. And a very peaceful and cordial transition from one governor to the next. So that helped establish that that tradition of transition of power as well.
Well, you referred to this these people as being elected. Who elected them? Were men and women voting?
Now, that's a great question. So only 41 of the 50 male adult males who came over on the Mayflower actually signed the compact. And so you can see the indentured servants were not among those who signed the compact. So there were distinctions that were made at the time as well. Only adult men signed the compact. So women were not permitted to, and according to the custom and the traditions at the time, they were not permitted to form a part of the governance of the colony. So it was the adult male. And the adult males who were the free adult males. But if you fast forward to the foundation of the United States as we know it today with the U.S. Constitution, at the time the Constitution was adopted, only 6% of the population were allowed to vote.
Yes.
So the landed, the propertied free males. And actually 20% of the population at the time were enslaved at the time of the adoption of the U.S. Constitution, which we think of the Revolutionary War as being fought for freedoms and liberty. And of course, only 6% having the right to vote. We've seen a lot of changes in our governance structure since that time. But again, the seeds of democracy were planted, and not only with the U.S. Constitution, but way back to the establishment of the Mayflower Compact and the Plymouth Plantation governance.
And for our listeners, you mentioned indentured servants. That was something of the time. Mm-hmm. And these people were not, I guess, slaves literally, but not far from it.
Right.
There were also many young children that came over as indentured slaves, young children.
Mm-hmm. As indentured servants as well. Uh-huh. And they actually had brought over orphans as well as part of the strangers, the group of strangers, but who they felt would be able to help work on the colony. So children were expected to work, including as indentured servants as well.
Now, of course, the North Atlantic had been crossed before many mm-hmm. times. There mm-hmm. were fishermen and other expeditions that had been over to North America, but still, mm-hmm. this was a dangerous voyage.
Oh, absolutely. And as you say, people had crossed over before, and in fact, although we think of Plymouth Plantation as being one of the first, it actually wasn't the first. The first actual settlement was in Jamestown in 1607, and they actually had the first House of Burgesses meeting in 1619, which was a year before the Pilgrims came over on the Mayflower. But it wasn't that type of a democratic system that was established kind of organically as it was through the Mayflower Compact. There were other colonies that were lost
right,
as well. The
Jamestown,
lost colony of Roanoke.
Yes.
Jamestown, the people of Jamestown had simply disappeared
right.
when the ship came back mm-hmm. there. Following
right,
before,
so they weren't
yes.
they weren't long established settlements, but there had been attempts made.
They do not know much about what happened to them.
Right. Yeah,
well, this
right.
was very much a matter of news and interest in England. Shakespeare wrote about it mm-hmm. in his plays, and again, we're talking about this seminal document for governance in the United States by those people who got off the Mayflower 400 years ago. Next year, and how that may have evolved into what we. Now, you know, look at very reverently as the United States Constitution, which is itself an evolving document. Julia, how did a bunch of independent colonies, very much different from each other in some ways, become the United States?
Yes, that's interesting. And the loyalty of each person within each of the colonies was really to their particular colony, their individual colony. So I am a Virginian, or I am a Rhode Islander, not necessarily I am from the United States. They really thought of each other, of their own colonies as independent states or independent nations. However, with the development of the colonies and the colonial democracies, again, democracy with a small d, because not everyone was voting or allowed to vote, but they were based on self-governance and self-rule initially, in part because the voyage back and forth across the Atlantic was very dangerous. It didn't happen very frequently, so it was very difficult for the king at first to be able to exert any control over the colonies. And so they really grew up under this democratic self-rule. However, when fast forward quite a few decades and a century, then King George, as we know, tried to clamp down more on the colonies and wanted the balance of trade to be more in the favor of England rather than the colonies, and tried to assert a lot more royal rule over the colonies and take away some of that independence and democracy that they had grown up under. And of course, the colonists rebelled at that. They didn't want to give up their democracy and their freedoms and be told what to do by this king who was clamping down on them more severely. And so we have the iconic instance of the Boston Tea Party, for example, in 1773, where the colonists rebelled against the tea tax that King George was attempting to impose. And the Stamp Acts. And this led to each of the colonies saying, we need to band together and throw off this tyrannical king, and therefore come together and form an army initially. The Continental Congress was really there to oversee the direction of the Revolutionary War. And then after they won the war, the Continental Congress thought, okay, well, we need a way to govern ourselves, and initially came up with the Articles of Confederation that you had mentioned previously.
Well, let's get back to Janet, because, Janet, they have a Mayflower Compact. They've got this sort of legal process now, and they kept records. And John Billington keeps showing up. In 1621, John Billington Sr., challenged Miles Standish's orders for contempt of the captain's lawful command with several speeches. So he was outspoken, I take it.
Well, I guess he was very outspoken, and I guess there were even occasions where Eleanor, his wife, became quite outspoken, too. So That's another story.
Well, 6 years after John Billington was tried and hanged, she was sentenced to sit in the stocks and whip
that's
for
right.
slandering John Doan. So it was
that's
another
right.
man of
that's
history.
Right. But I do have to say, we have to remember who wrote these records. They
yes.
were Ruth. They were Brewster and Bradford, who did not like John Billington. Well, although he lived right across from each of them, right across and kitty corner for them. Their homes, they got plots by a drawing, and it just so happened that he was right on one of the main corners, and they were too.
Well, they shared a neighborhood.
they all shared a very small neighborhood.
Yes, and there's one more entry here that in 1624, John Billington was implicated for a revolt against the rule of the Plymouth Church. So the church was an important part of this governance thing, too, I take it.
Oh, absolutely. The church, again, we don't have the separation of church and state back in that time that we would have thought about today. And even though the separatists from the Church of England were fleeing England so that they could practice their own religion, so they were fleeing religious persecution, that's not to say that they were completely tolerant either. In terms of religion, so those who came to the colony were expected to, I at least adhere to a certain extent to the religious order that the colonists then established. Now, within Plymouth Colony, they were a bit more tolerant, perhaps, than we might think of as the Puritans, for example, in Massachusetts. And, of course, we remember the Salem witch trials and instances where you were required to go to church, otherwise you would have a fine, that type of thing. And they were actually a bit more tolerant in Plymouth Colony than in other, perhaps other times and other places. But there was still not the religious tolerance and religious freedom that we would think of today.
And just finally here, we've been mentioning this, but in 1630, John Billington was tried and hanged for the murder of another colonist.
Mm-hmm. Mom, do you want to talk about that story?
Well, there are several different stories, and there's not much written, but by this time, they had been given property outside. They had divided properties outside of the little village that they had established. And it was given according to the number of people in the households, even if it was children. They were given acres by that. And John Billington had property down by the waters. And there was a young man that came over on one of the later boats, and he kept stealing from John Billington's traps. And John Billington didn't like that, and he had told him that he was not to be on his property, and it continued. I have been told, or I've read, that he actually was trying to scare the young man, but he did not just scare him. He shot him.
Well, he got the distinction of being the first man hanged by Plymouth Colony. He was about 40 years old when that happened. Janet, thank you for joining us today.
It's been great fun. Thank you.
Julia, good fortune to you.
Thank you very much.
That was UND Associate Professor of Law Julia Ernst and her mother, Janet, talking about the Mayflower Compact and its relationship to the U.S. Constitution. We spoke to them in February. Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura offers a natural North Dakota essay about the state's natural attractions. Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats, and we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Fargo construction firm has been fined $10,000 for violation of North Dakota's one-call excavation law. The Public Service Commission says Xcel Energy filed 7 separate complaints against Master Construction for work done in the city of Fargo. PSC Chairman Brian Crosius says Xcel had damage to some of its 5/8-inch natural gas lines.
The complaint is that Master failed to conduct excavation in a careful and prudent manner, so that's consistent on all 7 of them.
The commission did not suspend any of the fine because Master has had past cases of not following the one-call law. Crosius says he is strongly urging the construction company to work with the one-call organization. He says the group provides training on what contractors should and shouldn't do.
You know, we're talking about safety. You can have damage, physical damage to property, but when you're hitting natural gas lines, it goes without saying that's a very dangerous situation. And when this is occurring over and over again, repeatedly, something isn't working on their end.
The PSC also levied a $3,400 fine against a Minnesota construction company for similar one-call violations. Akrasha says $1,000 was suspended because Gladden Construction is a first-time offender. Midstream companies are continuing to make investments in the Bakken to produce natural gas and lower the amount of flaring. The companies would build gathering and transmission pipelines and processing plants. North Dakota Pipeline Authority Director Justin Kringstad says four new processing plants have opened and another four will open soon. One more is awaiting approval.
As we move into late 2019 and we start to see numbers early 2020, we will see substantial growth in the amount of volume of gas being run through these facilities and being captured out in the field.
Kringstad says they will add another 1.2 billion cubic feet per day of processed natural gas, but he says there is still a need for more.
The industry has a substantial amount of additional investment that will be needed in order to expand processing facilities, gathering capabilities, any type of interstate transmission needs for the region in order to, again, continue to move this gas to markets inside and outside of the region.
Gas capture rates ticked up slightly in September to 82% from August's 81%. And ag leaders in Minnesota are finding a strong demand for their Safe Talk series of farm meetings. The training sessions are geared toward farmers and ag workers dealing with stress and suicidal thoughts. Nine sessions have been scheduled so far, and officials say there is a waiting list for any future talks. North Dakota Ag Commissioner Doug Goring says the state did not have resources to put a similar program into place, but that doesn't mean the state is seeing similar issues.
If you look at it, CDC reports that suicide rates among farmers are higher than any other occupation, and it's actually five times higher than the population as a whole.
Goring, who is also an active farmer, says he can understand why.
You feel like you're doing this alone. You control nothing about your aspect. The weather, the markets, I mean, we talk about those things, and it just kind of rolls off our tongue when we say it anymore. But the reality is, you look at those factors that we don't control, low prices, high input costs. You got trade wars. You have tariffs that are imposed on our farmers and ranchers globally from all kinds of countries.
Goring says while the state does not have a Safe Talk series, there are resources available. He says if you are a farmer feeling stressed or you know a farmer that is having difficulty, operations like the 211 helpline or the National Suicide Prevention Hotline are available at all times of the day. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-277-8255 or 1-800-277-TALK. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Next time on The Pulse, the police officer violated his own rule.
Watch the hands, watch the hands, watch the hands.
And moments into a routine traffic stop, he found himself fighting for his life.
With all that I had.
What are scientists learning about making the right decision in these high-stress situations?
We call this like a single-breath reset.
A look at science and policing.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is the author of Natural North Dakota, the essays you hear on Prairie Public and, of course, on Main Street as well. Chuck is a former professor of biology, but he is a naturalist, even in retirement. And today he's going to talk about the best natural sites in North Dakota, which has attracted a lot of Facebook action and web hits. Here's Chuck.
Americans seem to enjoy lists. I was reminded of that recently when I happened upon a website that contained a list of the 10 most incredible natural attractions in North Dakota that everyone should visit. They noted that North Dakota has way more beautiful spots in nature than most people realize. They also note that everyone should visit at least one of these sites. I would agree, but there might be some differences in opinion as to what makes the top 10. Here's their list, in no particular order. Crowflies High Butte on the Missouri River west of Newtown, Upper Souris National Wildlife Refuge along the Souris River northwest of Minot, the Wildwood Hiking Trail in Icelandic State Park, west of Cavalier, Fort Ransom State Park near Fort Ransom, Cross Ranch State Park along the Missouri River south of Washburn, Graham's Island State Park on Devil's Lake, and Theodore Roosevelt National Park, plus three locations within the park, the Cannonball Concretions Pullout and Caprock Coulee Trail in the north unit south of Watford City, and Wind Canyon Trail in the south unit near Medora. I noticed that the website also had a list of the top 7 most incredible natural wonders in North Dakota, which is quite different. Again, in no particular order, they list Theodore Roosevelt National Park, Chase Lake, known for its pelicans north of Medina, the Red River of the North, the Missouri-Yellowstone Confluence west of Williston, the Cheyenne National Grasslands east of Lisbon around McLeod, the Pemina Gorge along the Pemina River near Walhalla, and White Butte, the highest point in North Dakota, which is south of Amadon. Of course, these lists beg discussion as to our favorite natural attractions and wonders. We would love to hear about your favorite natural spots in North Dakota. Just go to Prairie Public's Facebook page and post your favorite or favorites. And if you're interested, I've put a link to these 2 lists along with a text of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, celebrating 50 years of serving individuals and businesses in North Dakota, offering personal and business banking, mortgage, insurance, and investments, and striving to take their customers and communities farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in our Fargo studio. And in Bismarck, Sue Balcom, it's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You join us once a week to talk about food, and oftentimes you send a little cheat sheet. And I'm very glad of this first one that you sent because it just fully...
Validates.
It validates my old bread hoarding.
Well, you know, I've been known to cut the mold off of my bread and eat it.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, like, come
Not
on.
Not the mold, the bread.
Not the mold. But that's where penicillin came from.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I justify that. But, yeah, people, you know, there's more artisan breads out there today. Mm-hmm. And the price is a little bit more than what you'd buy at your local grocery store. But there's a reason for that. You know, these breads have not very many additives in. And so they don't last for decades on your counter because they're not supposed to. That's unnatural in my mind. If
right.
things don't spoil, there's something wrong with them.
Well, right. then maybe I need to share a pet peeve for people who live by themselves for the need to have half loaves of bread sold.
Do you know what? I started making mini loaves just
yeah.
for people who are single or living alone so that they don't have to feel like they have to eat a whole loaf of bread. So what I tell them if I don't have little loaves of bread is that they should actually slice it up and then double bag it and put it in the freezer. And
yes.
then you can always take it out and toast it. I'm not a big fan of microwaving things like that that I'm going to actually eat right away. But I have heard that you can do that because then your butter will melt on that bread. But toasting it is the way to go, especially homemade bread makes the fabulous toast, just fabulous
mm-hmm.
toast.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other things that you can do. We freeze leftover bread when I have leftover bread at farmers markets, and we take it out of its paper because a good artisan loaf of bread is better wrapped in cotton or linen, put in a linen bag actually to keep the crust crusty and the inside tender. But once you cut it, you're going to have to probably put it into plastic, which that retains moisture and kind of like promotes that mold growth. I have had sourdough bread that's lasted, you know, 5 or 6 days on the counter, but usually you want to eat it up before then or freeze it. You do not want to put it in the refrigerator. I have been working for 12 years to get my husband to not put my bread or pie in the refrigerator. It makes it stale. It just does something to the gluten content. It just makes it not very palatable. So always freeze your bread. Now, if you have a fancy crusty loaf of bread and you take it out of the freezer, you can make it taste almost brand new by giving it a little wash underneath your mm-hmm. faucet and putting it in the oven for 10 or 15 minutes at 350 degrees.
Never heard of that.
Oh, my gosh. And you know what?
It's the best I'm pretend super fancy holiday trick.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Yeah. And I never had much confidence in it until JC started doing it. And I'm like, where'd you find this loaf of bread? And he's like, well, I did what you said and took it out of the freezer and wet it down and rebaked it. And I'm like, it works. It really works. But something else you can do, of course, if you make quesnifla and you need breadcrumbs, sourdough breadcrumbs are the bomb. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. So you can cube your bread up and lay it on the counter till it dries out and then put it in a Cuisinart blender type thing and make little crumbs out of it. And then you can use them in meatballs, meatloaf. You can toast those crumbs and eat them on top of soup. You can use them as a soup thickener. You can freeze them. There's a bazillion things you can do with day-old bread besides French toast, which isn't all bad.
Or you can put it in a can and you can put a label on it and sell it for $2.
Oh, I never thought of that, man. I could start selling stuffing cubes,
yeah,
right?
Because that's available everywhere. And again, that's a reminder that stuffing is largely stale bread.
Absolutely. And so I always saved, even when I purchased bread before I started baking so much of it, always saved that extra bread for stuffing. And then, of course, it is like coming up on Thanksgiving, and you're going to need those cubes to make stuffing for that bird or quail or chicken or whatever.
Or to just eat.
Just to eat. Oh, my gosh. I love stuffing. My mom made really great stuffing, and my daughter asked for her recipe, and she wrote it down, and it's so cute because she couldn't spell. You know, her first language was German, and so I took scans of that and kind of saved it. But you get your bread cubes ready early on, like the week before, cut them up and dry them out. Now, I wouldn't leave them lay on the counter, especially if you had a cat or a dog or somebody around that's going to be eating on them. But, you know, you can use your microwave or your oven to keep them contained until they're dried enough to either freeze again or get your stuffing made.
Do you, when you have a mix of breads, do you store those all in the same container?
You mean like if I was going to use them for stuffing?
And you have rye and you have
because just think of how complex your flavors will be in that stuffing. If you have, I even used cinnamon bread, and that adds just a little hint of sweetness to it. And everybody's like, "Wow, what is it that I taste?" They can't quite put their finger on it, but it's there with the sage and all the oregano, whatever you use to season your stuffing with.
Sue, I just thought of another purpose for my other half of that bread loaf that I can't eat in time, which is bread pudding.
Oh, my gosh. I love bread pudding. It's absolutely one of my favorites, but there are a lot of people that don't even know you can make bread pudding because that's something that's really kind of like old-fashioned. And I remember working at the restaurant in the 70s, and we used to take all the stale bread and make bread pudding for Sunday's dinner dessert. You can, eat that with maple syrup and call it breakfast. You can put caramel sauce on it. You can add apples to bread pudding. There's a bazillion things you can do. But yeah, I love bread pudding.
I once got into an eating competition at one of the fanciest restaurants in Winnipeg over bread pudding.
Well, how'd you do?
It was free. I'll just put it that way.
Well, somebody got the T-shirt.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And there's another recipe that I found that's called Skier's French Toast. So let's say you're going to have a great big brunch instead of a Thanksgiving dinner, over the weekend. You cube your bread up or slice your bread up and put your seasonings in there, and it's covered with eggs, and you leave it overnight in your refrigerator. Then you bake it in the morning, and then eat it with maple syrup, and it's kind of like a eggy bread pudding breakfast kind of thing.
Well, how many egg bakes do use bread? I mean, it's a common bread or potatoes.
Yeah. Yep, got to hold it together with something, which is really good for when you're doing your meatloaf and stuff, you always put something in there starchy that kind of holds that stuff together.
Do these storage tips apply to sweetbreads as well?
Are you talking about
like a banana bread? on the random, insane reason you wouldn't eat the whole thing in one sitting.
Oh, come on now. Who wouldn't eat a whole loaf of banana bread?
I have no friend of mine.
I would freeze that whole or cut half of it off. I wouldn't slice it individually.
Okay.
And I certainly don't think that I would put it in the toaster. And I wouldn't probably make breadcrumbs or cubes out of it. Because you got to eat it.
But the fridge thing
is fine. Anything, pies, any of those quick breads, caramel rolls, anything that has kind of a flour base to it, there's just something about putting it in the refrigerator that's just – it just grosses me out. Even pizza crust, you know, gets kind of wonky when you put it in the fridge. And where I work, they don't bother wrapping it up. They just put it in the cardboard box and put it in the fridge, which – is even worse because then it starts to curl. You know, who wants to eat curly pizza?
Well, me. It depends on the time of day.
Oh, God.
We check in with Sue Belcom at least once a week for Main Street Eats.
Thank you, Sue.
Oh, thanks, guys.
What's happening is next.
Classical music parodist Peter Schickele spent some formative years in North Dakota.
We continued on to Fargo. I remember my mother in the front seat of the car crying softly.
The Juilliard-trained musician and comedian whose alter ego P.D.Q. Bach invented punny instruments like the dill piccolo for playing sour notes, will be on Prairie Public Presents this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central 4 Mountain as we encore his 2017 performance of a new piece with the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra. You'll also hear a hilarious Q&A with the audience and reflections of Peter Schickele's homecoming show with Linda Boyd, recently retired director of the FM Symphony, who likened his music and humor to Monty Python.
Even if you're not a big classical music buff, it's pretty obvious humor, and it's just a lot of fun.
So listen and enjoy some homespun musical humor with Peter Schickele, a.k.a. PDQ Bach, Sunday on Prairie Public Presents.
Well, a week from today, it'll be Thanksgiving, but in the meantime, there's stuff going on. Ashley Thornburg and I look at our What's Happening calendar of things to do every week.
And there is going to be a performance here of classically trained cellists and pianists playing at the North Dakota Museum of Art. This is in combination with Mayville State University. So this is happening Sunday and Monday. Sunday at 2 p.m., it is at the North Dakota Museum of Art, which is in Grand Forks. And on Monday, it's 7:30 at Mayville State University. Cellist Thomas Mesa and the Russian pianist Ilya Yakushev are performing intimate classics. And this just sounds like a really lovely performance. Tickets are anywhere from $15 to $110 to go see a cellist and a pianist performing intimate classics.
Sensational Sundays, the Turtle Mountain Chippewa and Métis is featured in Bismarck on Sunday at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. November is Native American Heritage Month, as we've reminded you several times. This month is a time to celebrate the rich and diverse cultures, traditions, and histories, and to acknowledge the important contributions of Native people. So again, this is Sunday at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. It takes place at 2 in the afternoon, and it's free.
Well, if eating a lot on Thanksgiving and Christmas and a bunch of times in between is still not enough for you, you can try Gobble Till You Wobble. This is an event happening in Rothsay, Minnesota, coming up on the 23rd. It is a benefit for the Hoof Beats for Healing Equine Therapy. So there is going to be a spaghetti dinner that runs from 4 to 7 p.m. with a suggested donation of just $5. And then there's also going to be a dinner, a dance, and a silent auction. The dance is available for a $10 donation. This is Saturday, 4 to 11 p.m. in Rothsay, Minnesota. And this is a good family-friendly event, the Gobble Till You Wobble.
Well, how about the first annual gingerbread house competition at Chateau de Mora State Historic Site? It takes place from Monday through December 7th, of course, at Medora. It's open to ages 5 and older. This contest will showcase gingerbread creations in various categories. Those creations will be displayed at the Chateau Interpretive Center. You can vote for a People's Choice Award, which will be taking place December 6th and 7th from 9 to 4 at the Interpretive Center and on Facebook. And cash prizes will be awarded to category winners on December 7th. Entry forms are due by 5 on Monday. That's this coming Monday. It's a family-friendly event again. And for entry forms and registration information, well, you can Google the first annual gingerbread house competition at Chateau de Morris State Historic Site. There's lots of information just in that title. And that's coming up on Monday through December 7th.
November 22nd and 23rd at Peace Lutheran Church in Fargo, the NDSU Opera is going to be performing a selection from the opera Julius Caesar. This is one of Handel's operas, and this is presented with the Baroque Festival Orchestra. Again, this is the 22nd and 23rd in Fargo at Peace Lutheran Church. Friday and Saturday shows are at 7:30 p.m., open for free to NDSU students, and $5 for seniors and $10 for adults.
There's going to be a homemade artisan fair in Foreman on Saturday at the Sargent County Museum. You can enjoy the sights, smells, and tastes of Christmas. The museum is heated and ready for you to shop for gifts for yourself. Kids' table will also be there for making some ornaments. It's kid-friendly, obviously, and it runs Saturday from 10 to 3. That's the Homemade Artisan Fair at the Sargent County Museum in Foreman on Saturday.
The Barnes County Historical Society Lecture Series is hosting Dr. Terry Shoptaw to talk about his book. I love this title, Sons of the Wild Jackass, the Nonpartisan League in North Dakota. I would not have guessed that they were referring to the Nonpartisan League there. This is happening Friday at 7 p.m. at the Barnes County Historical Society Museum. You get to hear the story of the Farmers' Revolt in North Dakota and how that fundamentally changed the power structure of the ag industry within the state. And again, this is Friday at 7 p.m. at the Barnes County Historical Society Museum, and it's free.
And he's also speaking this evening at Zanbro's in downtown Fargo at 7 o'clock. That's Terry Shoptaw, the author of Sons of the Wild Jackass, that controversial title. And we've got another Handel music piece coming up, too, the 90th consecutive annual performance of The Messiah. This is in Bismarck on Sunday at Trinity Lutheran Church, performed by a community chorus, a chamber orchestra, and four soloists, and it's directed by David Fandrick. Again, it's on Sunday, and it takes place at 7:30 in the evening at Trinity Lutheran Church. The cost is $10, and students through college, $5. So there you go. Handel's Messiah.
There is an holiday art sale. This is Friday and Saturday at the Plains Art Museum in Fargo, and you can get a lot of handmade objects from local and regional artists, jewelry, prints, photography, pottery, ceramics, you name it. Friday and Saturday, 9 to 5. And check out some of the exhibits that are at the Plains Art Museum, especially with that free admission. We had Brad Kallhammer on the show recently, and he has a beautiful exhibit up right now.
Well, that annual crystal market thing is going to start in downtown Fargo, too, and that's running this weekend. It's going to be at Drecker's, which is right in downtown, and you'll be able to have some treats, buy some stuff. You know, it's a market.
Right.
And it's fitting for the season. It has moved around a bit in downtown Fargo, but this year it's at Drecker's. What's your pick?
My pick, well, is more holiday shopping, but you can support local artisans and crafters with the Pride of Dakota show. This one happens to be in Fargo. They've been in Grand Forks and Minot. They will be in Bismarck coming up. I think there's a Jamestown and a Valley City in there somewhere. Check out the Pride of Dakota website for all of the different shows. But in Fargo this weekend, it is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 4 to 9 Friday, 9 to 5 on Saturday, 11 to 4 on Sunday. It's free admission, and there's so much to choose from and a lot of really cool stuff at these shows.
Well, here's my pick. Hands-on Photograph Preservation Workshop. It's offered by the North Dakota State Archives and State Library. This is quite a deal. It's at the Bismarck Veterans Memorial Public Library on Tuesday. It will feature staff from the archives and the library presenting strategies for organizing family photographs and making items easy to find and share. Again, it's on Tuesday at the Bismarck Veterans Memorial Public Library from 1 to 4. It costs $10. That's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 21st. On this date in 1922, hunters greeted the beginning of deer season. Or rather, they were supposed to. Initially, some had greeted it earlier in the month, on the 10th. There was a lot of confusion on the point. It had been announced by the Game and Fish Department that the season would begin on November 21st and run through the end of the month, 10 days in keeping with the intent of the law. However, near the beginning of November, an opinion from the Attorney General's office appearing in local newspapers created some confusion. The statement read that the season should run from November 10th to the 30th, in accordance with laws from the 1919 legislative session. But the statement referenced many sections of hunting laws enacted over the years and ultimately noted that the law had not really changed, but the statement still had an effect. In mid-November, the Ward County Independent noted that the chief warden of the 1st State District of Upham had declared the season opened November 10th and ran through December 1st, so many hunters in Ward County were already out. The Washburn Leader also reported the deer season opened the 10th of November, and the first day found a large number of local hunters in the woods along the river bottoms. Yet other papers continued to publish notices that deer season began on the 21st, as per Game and Fish Department. Consequently, many hunters waited for that 10-day season to begin. The Pioneer Express in Pembina summed it up well in reports received from Fargo. Big game hunters of the state are trying to find out when they are allowed to shoot deer. The state law gives November 21st to 30th as the days for open season. But the Attorney General's office gives the opening date as November 10th. A few hunters are starting on trips today, but following an appeal from the Game Board, which says that if all hunters shoot from November 10th to the 30th, practically all deer will be killed off. Most hunters are planning to wait until November 21st. But perhaps the best season was had by a farm family near Manoman, Minnesota, who made a deer their pet. Concerned about hunting season, they covered their pet with a red blanket. That deer was fine. It never left their yard. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Friday on Main Street, the VA Medical Foster Home Program allows veterans to find care in a home setting rather than a nursing home. And we'll talk about this option for veterans and how caregivers can become involved with the program coordinator for the Fargo-Moorhead region, Kristen Swinson. News director Dave Thompson will analyze the week's big stories, and Matt Olin will review Ford versus Ferrari. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.